Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is titled This Useless Beauty and is about two exciting new poetry books, one entitled, of course, This Useless Beauty, and the other entitled The Ugly Side of the Lake. Our guest for this episode is someone who knows something about these two collections of poems and, well, being on this podcast a lot, Mr. Jason Baldinger. Hello, welcome back. It's been 15 whole episodes?
Yeah. Wow. I think I was here in February with Steph Brea.
Oh, that's right. You were.
I
tried to be quiet. 50 and then you were after like in 51.
Yeah. Yeah, I tried to be very quiet. I want Steph to have the episode, but you might hear remnants of me in the background.
That's for that right.
One. So yeah, it's been a couple of months, and books happened.
Yes, they have. Yes, they have. And
they
we're plugging
in droves.
Books. They are happening in droves. You are in writing and publishing beast mode.
I seem to be. Yes.
And what an exciting thing! And well, let's just fucking get this out of the way. I think This Useless Beauty is the finest thing you've done.
Oh, thank you.
Of all of that one, it has a weight to it. It has a somberness to it. Maybe that's just my own fetish. maybe it just lands my fetishes perfectly. But I think these poems, and maybe for me, how I'm thinking and feeling at this moment in history. These poems kind of nail it.
It's appreciated. I mean, this with This Useless Beauty, it's kind of some older poems that didn't make a book called Fragments of the Rainy Season, which is not out yet. Is coming out the end of this year, probably. So there's a few things that I kind of made peace with. As a writer, we have our trash pile, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you have your trash pile for your writings.
Mm-hmm.
As well.
Mm-hmm.
There's poems that don't work for whatever reason, and I've gotten a little bolder as publications have continued to happen about just floating some of those poems and going, there's no chance in hell that this is going to get picked up, and then that's the poem that gets picked up. And then when it gets posted, all of a sudden, that's the poem that people are talking to me about. And it's like, I hate that fucking poem. Completely did not expect that response. I think this is junk. You know?
Wow.
So this brings me to that place where I am reminded, essentially, that you don't own the work. Once it leaves the pen, once it leaves your head, it's not yours to appraise.
Roland Barthes, Death of the Author. That's two podcasts in a row. No, actually, not in a row. We did Skullcast. But the last podcast I recorded that came out before a podcast I recorded earlier, we talked about Roland Barthes in this room on Sunday of last week.
Yeah.
And so here we are, Death of the Author yet again.
Yeah.
Or for me, sometimes, because I'm in a similar place where I'm waiting for peer review to come back on an academic manuscript.
Okay.
And I oscillate between, I'm a genius and I'm going to have a breakthrough, or I'm the dumbest motherfucker on the planet,
right,
and the review is going to come back, yeah, no, this is just not.
This is tripe.
This is, yeah. And I don't know which one, and what I said to people when I submitted it in January is I'm just word blind to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just letters in a sequence, and I have no idea if it's good or not, but good anymore or bad anymore. I've agonized over it so much, I have no perspective on it whatsoever.
And maybe that's the best place to be as a writer in some respects, because, again, it's not yours. Once you've created this thing, everybody else has to decide what it is.
Yeah.
You know, it can be what it is to you, but you can't make anybody think what you thought this was. You know?
Which is such an odd, weird thing, know, with writing, because it is this solitary, and not that you don't think about audience, but it's such this solitary, singular thing. I remember giving up acting because fucking other actors. You know, I even had a director at the time who said, you know, this job would be great if it wasn't for the fucking actors.
Yeah, I understand that feeling.
You know, and I was like, no, I want to go write. And I'm just, it's just me and my brother word processor. And,
but you can't exist without community.
Yeah.
You know, so yes, the act itself is solitary, but if you want published, if you want
somebody to fucking read it,
somebody to read it, you have to go out there and you have to do it at the same point in time and build that community to go with it. And then it's not yours to say, yes, I love this poem. And yeah, there are poems that I love, you know, that I wrote, but there are an equal amount that I cringe at. Wow. But simultaneously, maybe that's cringing because you hit something that, you know, you hit the bone necessarily.
Yeah, which also, I mean, thinking about this now, I mean, I guess then there's the other thing is the other piece of this puzzle is, of course, the issue of time.
Yes.
Are there works that you've published or written even, and maybe not shown anyone, that over time your perception of them has changed?
Yeah, yeah. The poem Unconditional Surrender, it's in This Useless Beauty, which is also in the Logos Anthology.
Yes.
Which... I wrote that poem 5 years ago.
Wow.
And I hated it. It's gone through iteration after iteration, trying to get it right. And when I was invited to submit to Low Ghost for that anthology, Unconditional Surrender, I sent two poems that I thought, yes, although I don't consider myself a love poem writer in any way, shape, or form. A lot of people consider that I do, and I do it very well. They took those two poems, but I put Unconditional Surrender in as the flyer poem, which is how I submit. You know, it's like, three poems? Okay, well, here's two that I think you'll take. Here's one that I don't think has a chance in hell of making it. And then I got an email back from Chris, and he's like, so we're going to take all three of your poems, and we want to make Unconditional Surrender the title poem. And I said, no. And he's like, no, you can't say no. And I said, okay, let me go back home and do one more edit on this poem, and whatever happens with it, you get it, and you take whichever version you prefer of it at that point. So I sat there and I just kept tugging at the string one night of the poem, and I pulled it apart for like the 70th time. And yeah, it's the poem got to what it needed to get to. It doesn't make it any easier of a poem to deal with in that regard. Probably because it's really open. You know, it's not glossing, you know, the end of a relationship or you know, trying to process how you deal with a relationship. So yeah, there's poems like that, you know, that it's like, no, that's an ancient poem at this point in time that was written at the time of Lady Pittsburgh, for God's sake, you know. So yeah, so it's some of those old poems, and then there's, again, as we were talking before we hit the record button, you know, since the end of 2016, whatever I broke in my head that has created this machine, I can turn out 2 to 4 poems a week usually, you know, for the most part at a decent clip of quality, I think.
Yeah, absolutely,
I'm not positive. You know, but it seems like yes in that regard. And so there's just a lot of stuff laying around, you know, that it was like, well, let's jam this all together and see what happens. And I kind of wish that Fragments of the Rainy Season had come out before it, because I think those books inform each other very well. But that's coming soon.
It'll happen. It's going to happen.
Yeah, it's coming.
It's coming. Which I think also... Not that I wanted to go there with this podcast, but I think we should, as a public service.
Yes.
As public pedagogy. You know, thinking about what it means to write well or what it takes to write well. And perhaps the role of writing often.
Mm.
And writing within a community.
Yeah.
and how that, you know, especially, yeah, this paradox, right? We think writing is, I still sometimes think writing is the singular thing, but genius is a collective. It always is, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it also, I mean, with the internet, for better or for worse, in so many respects, I mean, I am a part of 7 different poetry forums, all modern, current authors throwing their voice out there into the void. And so you're meeting other writers that way.
Yeah.
And so as I write things, it takes the solitary out of it, because you can just immediately post it to one of those boards and somebody reads it and somebody makes a comment or somebody likes it, and it makes you all of a sudden think, all right, maybe this thing that I don't think is any good might have some merit, you know. And sometimes you get some creative or some creative direction or some criticism that helps the poem. Other times it's just an opportunity to see the poem a different way.
Yeah.
Or the artwork a different way. I mean, we don't have to make this specifically about poetry, but I mean, that's what we're talking about, I guess. So, and that also then helps build a community. There's that realization, at least for me, after that poetry festival in Kansas City in 2017, that it's not just a weird little local thing that's happening here in Pittsburgh. It's a national thing that you can be a part of if you so choose. And there's so much out there, you know, magazine, quarterly, online press, zine, you know, there's so many places to submit to and whatnot that you can easily start finding other people of the same mindset. You know, John Dorsey and I, who wrote The Ugly Side of the Lake together, come about in somewhat of that fashion. So the internet certainly keeps us in touch a lot easier than letters, because I'm a terrible letter writer, although I've started to take fond use of postcards.
I have one of those postcards. It was lovely.
You'll get more.
Good. Yay.
If I have your address, it's in a notebook. If you haven't moved, I'll send you another postcard at some point in time.
Good, because I hope to die in this house.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, good. Yeah, I just have to buy more postcards.
Cool. But yeah, so that's the other one, of course, The Other Side of the Lake. And, of course, that is also not a singular thing. I mean, that is, John Dorsey. There's two poets there. There's two.
Well, that was my first day of my residency in Missouri. I was at the Osage County Arts Community for a couple of weeks in April as the guest, basically, of John. And that first day I was there, John and I took a drive around Missouri. We went down to the Lake of the Ozarks, and we'd stop at a bar, or we'd stop here, wherever, you know, caught our attention. Mm-hmm. And catching up and, you know, getting to know each other and whatnot all at the same time. And by the evening, as we were heading into Jefferson City, he looked at me and he's like, "Well, do you think you could write 6 poems about today?" And I said, "Yeah, I think I could do that." And he's like, "Okay, I think I can too. So let's see if we can each turn 6 poems in, get them to me." And the next day we were reading with Diane Borsnick of Night Ballet Press in Arkansas. Diane's done books for me. She did the Studs Terkel Blues. And she's done books for John as well.
Yeah.
So John said to Diane, "Hey, we have this 12-poem chat book. Do you want it, Diane?" And she's like, "Yeah, hell yeah. Both of you? Sure." You know. So it was literally like I gave him the poems that night. He gave her the manuscript the next day.
Wow.
And, you know, we were confirmed as published by the end of the week. So
wow. that's how books happen. Yeah.
But yes, sometimes things happen so fast that you can't blink an eye. I mean, this Useless Beauty came out on Alien Buddha Press. I turned that in April 1st, and I had a rough draft, digital rough draft of the book and a book contract within 3 days. So, I mean, that's rapid fire in in a world that can take some time.
Yes.
You know, I've got a book that's been sitting at a publisher for 2 years, you know.
Mm.
So it's interesting how speed works in those regards.
Yes.
Should I read you a poem?
Yeah, why not? Why not? I could go some. We go somewhere else. We will go somewhere else. But yeah, read a poem. We're a solid 15 and a half minutes into this thing here. So
do you want one of your requested poems? Or?
I don't care. Whatever you're feeling, whatever you're thinking, right. Whatever.
Well, this has been relevant to a lot of things lately. So this is called "To the Fragility of Each Moment." Eating alone, a taqueria. The only other couple two tables away, a date. She's loud talking, a Disney princess, just finished a 5-minute spiel explaining her vocal range. A friend texts me, her ex-husband is getting married a week before what would be their 4th anniversary. She says the floodgates are open, the words won't stop, she wants to set everything on fire. I drift over a morning talk with a friend, waiting for a tea kettle shouts, after waking up on a garage floor still feeling the night before. He says he loves his wife, but he's not sure he's in love with her. He doesn't know what to do. It's cold tonight. I walk south side, back to the car, ahead for a bar to celebrate Svetik. A former cop, his poems bloom brutal, yet carry their heart. At one point, he announces cancer and dying. And not to make light, but we are all dying. Each of us in the abstract is the intersection of infinite and finite time. It seems the process of aging is understanding of the fragility of each moment. It's comprehending that every moment is terrifying and every moment is beautiful simultaneously. I look over at Newman. He grabs Jaquila, his wife, pulls her close, kisses her head. Later when she reads, she'll quote Sherman Alexie, "The world needs more kindness and hospitality." But now, she's an accidental Kim Novak. She smiles sweet. "Careful, or you'll muss me." One of the ones from This Useless Beauty.
Yes. Which... And for me, and that was one of the requested ones. Let's show the, you know, what's behind the curtain, Toto.
Yes.
Yes. What draws me to that poem or how that poem gave me pause. And I think maybe there's also, let's face it, I mean, we're older.
Yeah, I mean.
That's... this part of it. And the passage of time and having maybe seen enough of the world to see... To see
through it in some
respect. To see through it and to see and to have a sense of the fragility of it, and it's bad. I just did a George W. Bush.
You did.
I defined a poem by a word in the title. a fragility poem. It's about the fragility, you know.
For us in our 40s now.
Yeah.
You know. We've had friends pass away.
Yeah.
At a younger age, obviously.
At a younger age, but I remember when, I think the friend you're referring to in particular, I remember the first thing Danelle said to me after I found out, mm-hmm. I think when she texted me, was, she said, "Wow, we're now at the stage of our lives where our friends are going to be dying."
Yes. And this is just where you are. And also, you know, in your 40s, you're now... middle age. More than likely, yeah. You're well past middle age.
Yeah.
In both of our cases, probably past.
Yes.
You know.
Absolutely.
By a good 5 to 7 years.
At least. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And there comes a point in time where you don't believe in God. I don't believe in God. You have to find a way to make peace with your time on earth.
Yeah.
And understand what that time is and what you're doing with it. So you're answering your own mortality to some extent. Not necessarily preparing for it, because that's a different thing. And something also very important to do, not yet.
Yeah.
Well, but understanding it's coming and not just flying blind in the face of it, that's a really important stage of life, and maybe as educated persons, we have a little more luxury to do that. But still, it's a very important part of this age of your life.
Yeah, and I think, too, it's for me also having seen enough of the world to see, and not exactly that I think that I'm ever going waxy nostalgic on this or anything, but to also see how the world can, and to a certain degree, very much has fallen apart.
Yes. Well, you have that happening around us, too. The reality of the last couple of years, realistically for me, the last five, the permanence is, the bloom is off the rose of permanence in any way, shape,
the bloom is off the rose of permanence, the bloom is off the rose of American exceptionalism.
Yes.
The bloom is off the rose of the end of history.
Yes.
And
there's all these things that are being redefined, very much necessary, that these things are being redefined in front of us. And there's an active push from older white men generally to keep things the same when these walls need to be torn down. And
these walls are decaying from the inside.
And if you don't tear them down now, then we're only going to continue to exist in a decayed nostalgic sense of, loss, sense of...
Yeah, I think that's very much part of it. I mean, I think about even, my idea of safety is very different now. I mean, and maybe is it safety also politically? Nazis were a thing in the past. Remember that?
I've done some reading about World War II. I remember all about how that was supposed to be over,
Civil rights. It was in the rearview mirror, now, granted, that's a certain degree, I think, at least definitely on my part, of white male cluelessness, but...
There is a lot of that.
Myself
included, too. Yeah, I completely agree with you.
Yeah, but sometimes you just miss days when, everything didn't seem so important, or everything did seem permanent.
Yes.
It's just going to be like this, and the kind of shirts people wear might change a little bit, and cars are going to look different.
But that's also, in some respects, a little harder to do in your 40s.
Yeah, because I think you've seen enough.
You roll with it a little bit more.
In 20s, you roll with it. 20s, two decades feels like a lifetime. Feels like an eternity. Feels so long.
Right, but now you have the weight of time sitting on you. Or the stink of time on you, whichever you prefer, depending on how you measure things. You're supposed to be settled by this age. You're supposed to be looking, or maybe not looking. I mean, for a lot of Americans, certainly one of the reasons why we are where we are is a lot of Americans aren't looking. They're not paying attention.
Yeah, or didn't think they ever had to, or had any responsibility to, or... I think about the world my dad lived in. My dad was born in 1930, and he tried a couple jobs and he landed on the one he liked.
And he just stayed.
And he just stayed and was allowed to stay. And when the company did not need him or his division anymore, they actually offered a pension with healthcare and a buyout package and everything, and was able to. I think about if my dad was born in 1940.
Yeah.
And I was conversely maybe born in 1987, how different even my life would have been in terms of financial security. And instead of my dad being too old to work and too young to retire, he was just old enough to retire.
Yeah.
Still could have worked, but he just didn't. And had a life that, and that kind of stability. I mean, we are all the precariat.
Right? Yeah.
We all stand on the shifting sands, and... That is, that's part of the fragility of the fragility poem.
yes.
Is that for me. But also, I think that the collection as a whole, the weight of time, I think it's a great phrase, but you're like a poet, man. the weight of time as it works through this book. Ugly Side of the Lake is very much about place, and I think you do place incredibly well as well. Other
you
collections.
Replace like a novel.
Yeah.
You at least in my case, I replace like a novel. So.
Yeah. And the experiences in those places that you convey interestingly as you go through,
this kind of forgotten America, mm-hmm. this unknown America, this America that is... You drive... We were talking about this before you hit record, or I hit record. The America you drive by,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the America that we choose to want to see.
Yes.
You know.
Well, I mean... We could knock suburban America forever, but one of the benefits of suburban life has always been you don't have to think about the world outside your door or outside your plan, you know.
Yeah.
In a city, you're constantly forced to confront the fact that you're around all sorts of different types of people, which is awesome and probably what life should be, because you can't move forward in a bubble of just... Yes. white people, or a bubble of just white men, or whatnot. You need different voices.
You get doughy.
You get very doughy.
You get intellectually doughy.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't want to rail against the suburbs, but that's certainly a case.
Fuck the suburbs. I grew up in the suburbs. I did 18 hard years in the suburbs. I remember, 17. I remember when I turned 34, and I was like, I remember, okay, 20s. It's a lifetime, man. I've lived so long. I mean, just Morrissey in the head. Just Morrissey was my id. And thinking like, oh, if I just lived to 34. Actually, wait, because I did do those 2 years in Ridley Park, so it would have been... 35, thinking 35, 36. Wow. Once I make it past that, I won't have lived half my life in the suburbs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And this like thing like, okay, this is now I'm clean. I'm on the positive side of, because I don't know. It's, and maybe it was just the Jersey suburbs, but, you know, I once heard hell described as, you know, you're sitting at a giant banquet and it's beautiful and it's rich and you're starving, but the utensils are so big you can never manage to get any of the food in your mouth. And that is what that is.
Yeah, I didn't really get... I got the suburbs to some extent. I lived in the city until I was 12. I grew up on the north side. But my mother married my stepfather, and we moved out to Evans City, which in the late 80s was still very much rural America.
Yeah.
The suburbs came slowly and then very rapidly. Now that entire area is the suburbs, basically. There's still little pieces of rural America floating in there, but for the most part, you know, once you get to Cranberry, you now see the tax dodge in full effect, you know? And it's kind of gross.
it's awful. It is. And but you know, you think so you're America, especially when you talk about, and even when we talk, not only in poems, but even when we talk personally about sort of your road trips,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's so fascinating to think there are these glimpses of this other America that's supposedly part of us and supposedly was our ideal America.
Right.
That sort of exists as shells and ghosts and...
Well, it's the old weird America, to borrow the Graham Marcus phrase. That's what I still look for. And there are still little bits of it floating, again. Not much of it left. Doctor's office architecture and Walmart has killed it in so many ways. It's all homogenized and generally boring. But when you get just off the beaten path in the right space, the right moment, you can still... get that. No. See, this then becomes hard because what are you getting? Are you getting the lie that you were sold of the American dream or the American exceptionalism? And that this is also then the wrestle point, you know, in every book that I've written since the lower 48 is that American dream that we were given as a kid.
Yeah.
We were sold it. Down the line, work hard, behave, you will get where you want to go, you will make enough money, you will always have a job, you will have a house, you know, all these things were waiting for you. All you had to do was just buy in. And we're now here, and that dream has been dead for 20 years.
Yeah.
And nobody looked up as it died.
Yeah.
You know.
And nobody was aware. I think the other thing is we think how aware we are now of how that dream that we were sold
mm-hmm.
was not sold to everyone was, well, maybe it was sold to everyone, but not everybody could
participate or buy
in. Not everybody could buy in. Mm-hmm. And so, which is that double-edged sort of nostalgia and double-edged sort of looking at American history, mm-hmm. thinking, I don't know, maybe was there a gentleness? Maybe was there a New Deal? Remember the New Deal? That was fun.
Yeah, that was a good idea.
That was a good idea. But it's such a tough thing to wrestle through.
Right.
Through, you know, is what do you do with the knowledge of everything that just gets filtered out of nostalgia.
Mm-hmm. And that, yeah, then it becomes the needle for the balloon of every poem that I write, in some respect. I mean, was I looking for the old weird America? Well, yeah, well, then what was the old weird America? Because it wasn't... It's the dream that you wanted to believe that isn't there. Or is it the fact that people are just getting by somehow and living their own life, and hopefully... inclusively, but not necessarily always in that respect. I don't know, you just gave me I just stumped myself in asking myself questions about my writings, so
to
some extent
we'll edit that out.
No, it's all right,
but
it's all right, it's good, because that means I'm still processing what I'm trying to do with this,
and that means your writing's still alive,
yes.
which is a good time. Which, speaking of writing being alive, you seem to have a chapbook open and ready.
I was looking for a poem that would kind of work with some of what we were talking about. So this is the first poem on The Ugly Side of the Lake. This is called A Postcard from Bell, Missouri. In a room that straddles the county line, the water tower overhead, pronouncing the town name to travelers coming north and south on Route 28. Two beagles chase each other across yards, under sheds, shrill barks in the wind. The Boo Radley house at the corner of 3rd, with its roof collapsed into a wide-open grin. The sidewalk starts at the Catholic church, the parishioners just leaving, imbued in Sunday morning light. The Baptist church parishioners just arriving, the multicolored truck, no muffler, passing once, passing twice, each time the driver waves. The garage door collapsed on itself, boarded back up, plywood to fill the gaps. The fire plug beckoning from some time in the 60s. The old oak tree lording over the vacant lot, waving from another era. The screen door, house number 410, blowing in the morning wind. The livestock auction barn that dominates the corner of 4th and Alvarado. The car wash that stares back. The patrons in the cafe downing coffee, biscuits, and gravy. The sign on the pool hall door, no weapons allowed in the pool hall. The bakery long since closed, the auto garage that caught fire, the carbon-stained door locked, not opened in years. The woman smoking a cigarette, bitching out the man in camo and ball hat. She quiets as we pass. He makes eye contact, sheepishly nods.
Is it also, not that we're dodging the previous issue, but is it also a matter of connecting with humanity that has come before and having that sense of history and having that, you know, if you go up the steps at the Carnegie Library, those marble steps at the Carnegie Library in Oakland, and the fact that years and years and years of feet have worn away the marble.
Yes.
You know.
So my thought as I was reading that was... the dream is dead, and I've struggled with the dream. Now that I understand the dream is dead, it's documenting what you're seeing instead.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what these poems are getting at more. Yeah, let's go with that. I'm going to roll with that answer.
No, I think that for me is why this Useless Beauty really appeals to me, because again, this moment in history where we're in the interregnum, we are in, it just feels like everything's falling apart. It feels like people in my life are falling apart. I mean, this July was a clusterfuck of people falling apart.
Yeah,
whether it's intellectually, medically, or just their lives.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of it over the last few weeks as well, so...
Yeah, and... Yeah, and for me, like, that feeling of... And I'll say this, and maybe this is just me trying to be Pollyanna, but... you know, I have these moments where I think, man, I hope, you know, 10 years from now we can look back and go, wow, that was really fucked.
Yeah.
You know, things are maybe stable, maybe okay, maybe less fractured, less decaying. I mean, I even think about just driving around. I mean, there's fucking sinkholes in this neighborhood. Not potholes, but actual places where the ground is giving away.
You've got Domino's Pizza offering to fill potholes now, and LeBron James opening public schools. Yeah. I mean, benevolent capitalism is one of the points of capitalism to some extent. And it's great, I guess.
It's good PR. But the fact that these things have to happen.
That's bullshit.
Say that, yeah, we're in an absolute moment of decay.
Right.
You know, where if you think about, you know, we the people are maybe kind of helpless.
That's seemingly what it feels like in a lot of respects. You know, this... you know, before the 2016 election, it felt like you were shouting in a bucket. Like, your voice didn't matter, no matter what. And I think that is still true. But after that election, there became every reason to find a way to poke the bear. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know where the bear begins or ends at this point in time.
Yeah.
But you gotta find a place, you know, and just start somewhere. And I see it starting, and I worry very much that it started too late.
Yeah.
We have 4 months to understand that. So please, if you're listening to this, register to vote, because fuck, it's the one thing that you could actually do to make a difference.
Well, I think there is direct action. I think there is still taking to the streets. I think there is boycotts and civil disobedience, and that's happening too. That is actually, if for me, that's where I find hope. Like, people shut down the parkway, sweet.
Yes.
You know, like,
that's what you want to see happening.
Yeah.
But honestly, the simplest thing that you can do without having to worry about getting arrested at this moment, is vote.
Yeah.
You know, vote for what you want, and if you don't see a candidate you want, unfortunately, pick the best, closest, and then look or vote or run for yourself or find somebody, you know, that can do it.
And you know, let's face it, one of the other mistakes that people made, you know, even when you elect that candidate, though, is you got to keep on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that was, did that, you know, we had the sigh of relief when Obama got elected.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh man, we can go back to the 90s again. It'll just be kind of chill.
Well, you
and it wasn't. Believe. Yeah. And could you imagine if during Obama, some of the civil disobedience that was happening now, like that he would have actually listened and he would have been like, oh, well, this is what people want. You can force me into doing this leftist thing now. You know, I guess there was a phrase Jilla Biafra has about, you know, FDR saying, you know, force me to do this.
Yeah.
And understanding that.
And that's kind of what you have to do. You have to force the hand. And if you can't get it through voting, if that system and the belief that that system is dead is in place, then, well, we have to do something completely different at that point in time. And that's going to require civil disobedience and sit-down strikes and boycotts and all the things that probably should already have happened en masse. But for the reasons we discussed earlier, Americans needing their jobs and their fucking healthcare.
Yeah.
It doesn't, you know. At least for those reasons. I mean, there's a lot more reasons.
There's a lot of reasons. I mean, you know, there's just enough. People are just not, you know. It's the Schopenhauer thing. You know, Schopenhauer's theory of this being the worst of all possible worlds. Have you heard this one?
No, I don't think I know that one.
Okay, so part of Arthur Schopenhauer's metaphysics is, as he said, this is the worst of all possible worlds. And to which people say, come on, man, it's not that bad. And he goes, that's the point. Is if it were any worse, we would either eliminate ourselves or at least stop procreating.
Yes.
So the pleasure in the world is there just enough to keep us going, thus allowing us to suffer tremendously along the way. And so the pleasure is actually in the purpose of suffering. Schopenhauer, nice, happy guy that he was.
Yeah, that's happy, man.
Yeah, that's happy. You know, it's the worst of all possible realms of existence. But I think there is a certain Schopenhauerian quality to our times where we have, you know, this entertainment, industrial entertainment complex that can make people happy just enough. You know, or like, oh, you got Netflix, you got Xbox, you got, you know, you do have the ability to go to Walmart and buy a ton of shit.
You can.
You know, and is that just enough for people to be like, well.
I just saw Sorry to Bother You, which is fantastic.
We were going to go tonight then, but we're here.
Yeah. No, that's all right.
I'm glad we're here. But
you should go see it, though.
I do want to go see that film, yes.
It's a really interesting, really entertaining, and really biting satire of now in a lot of respects. Even more dystopian now. But at one point in time, one of the characters, maybe it's the lead, sorry I didn't take notes, says, and the line just stuck in my head, if you give people a problem with no evident solution, they'll just get used to the problem. And that's exactly what Schopenhauer is saying in the same respect, you know? And that's what we're living through. You have no way of solving this problem. The largesse of government as we've created it makes it impossible to get through whole other series of conversations in there.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's also, too, is like, for me, you know, one of the things I keep saying, and it's part of me is the appeal to these places. Mm. I'm actually taking another friend to M&M Antiques and Furniture tomorrow.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. You know, place that we shared together, which it rained really hard, and so there's going to be puddles in the middle of the sales floor. But for me, I always say the 20th century is dying, whether it's people from the 20th century, but also is it then that 20th century way of life? Mm. Weird old America, I think about how I could also imagine myself, hopefully still being alive 10, 20 years from now, living a life that is radically different from anything I've known. And I have no idea what that's like.
Yeah.
But I think that's also inevitable. I think by, let's call it 2038, and hopefully the internet is forever, and people can be, yeah, dumb motherfucker. You know,
prediction is right.
We went back to the 70s. The cars got big again. It was weird, you know, lapels and everything. But those earmarks of maybe what middle class life was, those earmarks of what public life was, might be replaced by something that's different and quite literally unimaginable, at least to me, and I think to most people.
Well, I think we've reached that point already. I mean, you know.
The difference. You know what, though? But for me, it's like there's still cars and TV.
Right.
There's still cars, there's still TV, there's still pizza on Fridays.
That's fair.
You know, and I wonder, like, all of that cultural glue, cultural comfort. Mm-hmm. Is that going to survive the challenges ahead? And what it understands to maybe like that idea of, well, at least I can be middle class and have some stuff and, you know, not be rich, but, you know, is that what is imploding? Or at least going to be something radically different? Or we just, I don't know.
I don't know either.
There be sex bots?
That's probably true. With
what is the morality of sex bots? I said that in class once, and my sister was like, what? But like, yeah, well, how's your generation going to deal with sex bots?
There's so many
things. Is that infidelity or not? You know, I mean, Zygmunt Bauman, who I've now paraphrased five times this I'm getting ready to teach him again in the fall.
Yeah, that's fair.
Says, you know, he has a line in one of his books, and it says, you know, sociologists, the people whose discipline it is to understand social problems. He says, as much as we have a discipline that's supposed to do this, we only create lessons for the dead. Because once we figured it out, it's over.
That makes sense. I mean,
you know, it's already passed. And so, yeah, I wonder what lessons for the dead are we creating now?
We also don't seem to learn our lessons from the dead, though. Otherwise, yeah, there wouldn't be Nazis in the fucking streets.
Yeah, there would not be Nazis.
And there wouldn't be a president threatening, you know, nuclear war, because we would have processed the videos from Hiroshima not as another era, but as still currently and completely relevant and terrifying.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and, you know, here's the exception. So I will say this. this is a thing that happened to a colleague of mine. She was teaching a class at CCAC, and she had a student who was in her mid-30s who had never heard of atomic weapons. And never had the concept of destruction on that scale. I mean, literally, it was in her class, and she says, I think the student was 34, 35, and had no concept of atomic weapons or atomic warfare.
See, that's weird, because, I mean, you and I are the same age, so we grew up in that era of propaganda films.
Yeah.
Red Dawn, Cloak and Dagger, War Games.
War Games.
All, even Rocky IV, for fuck's sake.
Rocky IV, Top Gun.
Spies Like Us.
Yes.
You know, spoofing it, by and large. So, I mean, it was ubiquitous in the culture that we were served as young people. You know, all those movies came out between the ages of 6 and 12.
Yeah.
You know, so all that stuff is embedded in my head, and it seems impossible that you didn't know.
You didn't pick up on it, no.
Yeah, I mean, but then again, we didn't really talk about nuclear weapons in the 90s, and it wasn't until after September 11th that the concept of dirty bombs and you know, black market nuclear devices became I'll say threat in air quotes, because let's fucking face it, how much of a threat is it? It's never happened.
Yeah,
at this point in time, knock on something, for fuck's sake. Thank you.
There's wood underneath that. Yeah, I had that fifth grade. I remember my fifth grade teacher, Mr. Yartz, giving us the lowdown of what would happen if the bombs went off, if World War III started, and being either a first strike target or near enough to a first strike target.
Oh, you
and
were
how
in
you
Jersey?
Would prefer to be a first strike target, actually.
Okay.
Because you wouldn't want to live through the aftermath. You wouldn't want to live through nuclear fallout. And in fifth grade, we had a day in that, of fifth grade on that.
I don't remember anything like that. I don't remember even doing drills.
See, we didn't do drills, but there was this, like, well, like, you just felt like we needed to know.
Yeah.
If there is a nuclear war, this is what it's going to be like being on the I-95 corridor.
And I guess what all that was replaced with were our kids getting active shooter drills in school. And
stuff, I think that's part of the terrifying new, which is terrifying, which is also sort of localized. Yep. I guess that's the other thing, let's face it, not that there wasn't terror in the 90s, but there was a distance and a comfort that, let's face it, I don't think anybody has now.
Well, the Cold War won and the Cold War ended and we won. And I'll use that in air quotes, because obviously 20 plus years after the end of the Cold War, it seems as though Russia won. So, unfortunately,
no, they came back. They came back. It was the rematch.
Yeah. And we just weren't prepared, you know?
No.
The exigent sloth of Americans just.
Well, I think, you know, and you think that post Cold War period, you know, that triumph of American exceptionalism or whatever, when that was like the most halcyon, like we slingshotted from Reagan into just mushiness. We went from Reagan to like Friends and Seinfeld, you know, and just how shitty was that, you know?
Yeah.
But you know, we were just doughy. We were all doughy, you know. Yeah. It was nothing. And of course, 9/11 happened, and like the reaction went completely the other way. As doughy and slothful as we were, you know, we have now gone to a state of paranoia and panic that I think is dialed back a bit. But you know, how many rational public policy decisions have been made since 9/11?
No, I mean, that was the inception of fascism as a relevant part of American life.
And as a reasonable part of American life.
Yeah, and that has only grown in terrifying ways in the last 18 years, and certainly in the last three.
Yeah.
Faster than any of us would want to imagine, because, again, there's fucking Nazis in the streets.
Yeah, I got beat up. Yeah.
Punch a fucking Nazi for me, please.
Yes.
All right. I should read your poem again, huh?
Yeah, you should.
I mean, we're probably, at least 45 minutes right now?
Pretty fair. 50-15.
All right. Well, I'm going to read this for John Dorsey, my co-author. And again, I don't think we've actually said that the book release is happening on Thursday the 9th.
Of 2018.
It took us 50 minutes to get here.
August 2018. Yeah. There'll be links when this is posted.
But yeah, Thursday, August 9th, which is 1 week and 1 day from tonight. I guess we'll post this tomorrow, so be 1 week.
Well, you know, so I had a little technical difficulties. I was supposed to one today that I recorded a couple of weeks ago. So I was thinking about maybe going into the weekend, maybe I might do Friday or Sunday.
Well, as you're listening to it, it'll be less than a week away.
Yeah, it'll be less than a week away when you listen to it. Just because the fresh one just came out today. It was supposed to come out Monday, but things were broken because everything is broken. In 2018. So here we are.
Yes, so Thursday night, the 9th.
August 9th, 8 p.m. 2018, 8 p.m.
Brillo Box. Be myself.
Penn Avenue, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Yes. It would be myself, John Dorsey, and Victor Adam Clevenger. They're both coming in from Missouri. My friend Nicky Allen's coming in, former Pittsburgher, from Ohio. Vanessa Vesh, who is local. She is a member of Sweetheart of the Barricade. And she will be reading some poems. I think she has some of her bandmates joining her for that. And then we'll take a little break, and my band with several other poets, including Scott Silsby and Bob Paycheck, Pond Hockey, will play. And then my downstairs neighbor, John Dowling, and his wife, Pam, and my current housemate, Jay, their band, The Dumplings, will play. It's $5, and we will do our best to get you out by midnight, because I know it's still technically a school night.
Yes.
And if you happen to be listening to this in Ohio, we'll be in Cleveland the next night. John, Victor, and myself at Visible Voice. I think that's
Friday, August 10th.
Yes, at 6:30 or 7:30. I can't remember the time, unfortunately.
Is there a Facebook event page?
There is.
It will be linked in the post.
It will be linked. So this is for John Dorsey, and this is a poem called Winner, Winner, Chicken Dinner. I watch Paternity Court in the Rialto. Wait out the afternoon. There's a girl, four or five, hiding among the bar stools, and every now and again she jumps out at someone and yells, "Boo!" I'm sure not much has changed since you read at the tea tro. Somehow there are still underage ghosts hoping to be served. Pittsburgh Street still runs east-west. Cosmic bowling still brings them out. And when they get old enough, maybe they graduate to the head keeper. You said this is a drifter's town, and I believe you. This is the furthest isosceles angle of Pennsylvania's own Bermuda Triangle. It seems everything here disappears. I haven't seen or heard a Bigfoot. Instead, I wade in post-industrial debris, watch all the beaten faces barely flicker with emotion. The only building drawing a crowd is the Behavioral Health Center. You know, John, lately I feel like I'm being haunted by Van Gogh. Today, I may be in the potato eaters. The woman who just waited on me, the blood vessels had burst behind her right eye. She's telling someone she's old and tired and had enough. And I hear it's your birthday, brother. Nowadays, it seems that each plume of smoke is 20 years or 40 years. And somehow the time flows until it's time once again to kick out the crypt door screaming. It's time to bleed out another year, squeeze everything you can out of twilight. It's all coming, brother. It's all light speed. I'll have one more poem before we finish. It'll be new.
Oh, so new.
It'll be equally depressing, too. Sorry.
That's okay. Well, I think...
Somber.
somber. It feels good. I mean, you know what? The reading at Hemingway's last night.
Yeah.
That will always maybe be remembered as the Nick Nolte
reading. The Nick Nolte reading, yeah. I as I've done readings over the last few months, I tend to precurse it by saying, there's a lot of oceans and death in these poems. Sorry, I'm working through something.
But, you know, it was so amazing for me, like, that collection, not only that fucking Nick, actually, we're calling it the Nick Nolte, because Nick Nolte actually showed up in Hemingway's in Oakland.
Yeah, you're sitting next to Nick Nolte, and you're trying not to be at least a little starstruck.
A little starstruck, a little weirded out. Yeah. I mean, I want this actually to be recorded. So this guy walks in, and I was like, wow, that guy looks like a really old Nick Nolte. And then Jimmy, who's been mentioned in a poem before, says, oh, I want to say hi to my friend Nick Nolte. And I was like, oh, damn, you're making fun of your friend. And actually, it was Nick Nolte. It was actual Nolte, which I think I need to write a poem called Actual Nolte.
Actual Nolte.
Yeah. Actual Nolte. And you autographed a book for Nick Nolte. That's part of his now library.
Yeah.
You know, you think about it then. This is the way, your way to legitimacy, you know, because a lot of times when these celebrities, you know, pass on or whatever, you know, their papers, their stuff goes to some university archive somewhere. So UC Irvine will have Lady of Pittsburgh in a banker's box somewhere in a climate-controlled room. That will survive the fallout, but
and no offense to that book, but Jesus, I wish it was a better book.
it still has its moments.
Oh it's my first full length collection. There are really good poems in there, but
yeah, it still hits hard. 5 years
on, yeah,
I'm, yeah, rookie year, but it still hits hard. But it was the sense of community, the sense of even as people were. I mean. You know, during the open mic night, a vet from the Afghanistan conflict, which, by the way, speaking of American exceptionalism, that's still happening.
Yes.
That's still happening. Mm-hmm. We are still, actually, weirdly, according to some of the New York Times, we're kind of retreating a little bit. But it's still happening, but part of our strategy is retreating, because America
first. Do you want to discuss the conspiracy theory that we're only involved in it to promote the opioid crisis?
Well, I'll say that. Well, I don't know about promote, but so News World International, a side back, since you brought it up.
All right.
News World, well, I'll finish the first story. First story was, you know, this guy talking about being a medic in Afghanistan and having an Afghani fighter getting shot and what it was like, you know. Mm. As harrowing as that was, I think, to be together as a community and to acknowledge our collective humanity or the trauma of what we're going through. But, so anyway, News World International was this great news channel that existed.
Okay.
In my digital cable package, where if you wanted to, you could, and I would do this on lazy summer days, if you started at like 3 o'clock,
okay.
You started with, I think, German news in English, Japanese news in English. It was like the nightly news hour or a half hour. Awesome.
Yeah.
For everybody that basically had TV in English. Like okay. TV. So China English, Germany English, Japan English, ITV news from the UK, all of them back to back to back. CBC, I think there was a French one, you know, and it was just like, you could just, instead of watching like 24 hour news where it's the same shit over and over again or just talking heads, it's like,
yeah.
This is how we're covering this. This is how we're covering this. This is how we're covering this. And you got a sense of ideology and you get a sense, anyway, culture. Yeah. But one of the things they said about when, you know, when we still had it in 2002, it still existed, they were saying about, okay, now Afghanistan has been taken over. They're, you know, is a country that has essentially been at war since the mid-70s.
Yes.
And there is no infrastructure, and there is very little industry, and there's very little agriculture. And the ITV was like, well, what are people going to do? And knowing that one of the few cash crops that could be easily exported, same thing with Colombia, you know, was illicit drugs.
Yeah.
And if they either kind of turn the other way on this, also kind of casually mentioning that the Northern Alliance, which was the Taliban resistors, were all opium growers and all got in power. But saying, you know, do you either kind of go, oh, opioids are all poppies, okay, or realize that you're going to have this massively expensive famine, humanitarian crisis that will sweep an entire part of the globe. And I remember that happening. I remember seeing that, and I then remember hearing that some of the people I went to college with who were underclassmen started using heroin.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Well, it's the thing that makes you money, so you have to do it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, microcosm of that, the Confederacy and the Civil War only grew tobacco. They didn't grow food crops. They grew tobacco and other things that they could used to
turn
sell
cash. Yeah,
so the general population starved, and by the end of the Civil War, riots in the South were widespread. Stick that in your Confederacy flying flag, you know.
Bullshit. Yeah
exactly. It wasn't the rebellion you thought it was. It was rich white men going, no, we want our cake, and we're gonna eat it too. And we don't give a fuck about the poor, which is where we are 150 years later.
So what's this other poem?
I'll read you this new poem. I'll save the other one for the book launch, but this is called Beauty is a Rare Thing. We'll stick with the whole time and beauty and all this other stuff theme that we've been running with. We're on the back deck of a Civil War era farmhouse that somehow survived 150 years gated in Pimlico. He kept pulling out these perfectly rolled joints. The Reverend had run into the woods to make water on abandoned washer-dryer combos. We watched the ghost of owls in an ancient walnut tree. You told me of your wife's affair, your daughter, and the relationship you struggled to keep together. Fritz the cat spritzed the basement floor, all your art piled up, forgotten, age and time passing you by, depression its own hair trigger. I've heard it said that beauty is a rare thing. And it seems my artist friends know this and fear this equally. We scatter to document any evidence of it. We post it where we can, proof this whole fucking experiment of humanity isn't completely futile. That night we read in your shop to 6 people. We ate in some shitty bar in the Inner Harbor. You felt you had outlived yourself. The depression pulled you in, and I'm never sure you got back out. That night I couldn't sleep. I kept getting lost in the painting in the dining room, kept flipping through myriad books of photography, thinking about all our faulty human prayers. It would be a couple years before I saw you again. Friends of mine heard you were struggling. We came to visit, watch baseball, and talk records. I spent that evening DJing in the living room, while my friends raided every room, haggling, trying to get you to sell off impossibly rare LPs. After all these years of working around music, I began to see it like paintings, like poems, like sculpture. As something you can't truly own. We pass by it, accept it as it feeds us, and then we abandon it until our memory, or the next time. And I could see with each record a look, somewhat painful, wash around your face, as if you didn't understand, couldn't accept all these things were the sum of your legacy. After that, the depression pulled you back, and I didn't see you again. Social media tells me this mortal coil finally shook you. I hope somehow, as you found the end of this life, that life finally gave you some peace. Shall we just go to 5 questions now? Because I don't know if there's anything we can do.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything we can do to get out of that. But again, so the 2 books are called...
This Useless Beauty...
And The Ugly Side of the Lake.
Alien Buddha Press and Night Ballet Press.
Yes. Respectfully, again, links will be on the description.
Yes.
And, of course, there will also be a link to the book launch parties in Pittsburgh and Cleveland when we post this. Those are in 2018.
Yes.
October 9th and 10th. 9th Pittsburgh, 10th August. Cleveland. August!
It's not October yet.
But you'll probably have another book out by then.
It seems possible.
And you'll be back on the podcast, and I'll be happy.
Yes.
And now it's time for the bottom 5. The bottom 5 is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I think these are all new questions.
Okay.
Because you've been on so many times, and I don't feel like wading through all the forms.
I've Steve Martin'd this.
You Steve Martin'd this. Question 1. And these are truly the bottom 5. They're at the bottom of the list, the long list. What is your earliest memory?
Probably 4 years old, fourth birthday, and I got my first G.I. Joe action figure and vehicle. Weird that it's and this is also one of those interesting things that could lead us down a long rabbit hole of conversation. When we talk to people of our generation, your first memories are not always of something substantial. They're usually of something disposable, something you acquired as a gift or whatnot, you know, something material. And that kind of sucks. Something that we desperately should change out of American society. But
yeah,
that is my first memory. I can tell you, though, my mother tells the story of me being 2 years old. So winter of 78, which was particularly brutal here in Pittsburgh, and coming downstairs into the house that we lived in at that point in time, and getting up on a chair and looking out the window in the kitchen as she was either cooking breakfast or doing dishes or whatever, and I put my elbows on the windowsill and I sighed heavily and I looked up and I said, look at all this fucking snow. So there's two answers for
that. There's two answers for that. Love it. I realize we kind of answered question two, but I don't have a good go-to one. So if you had to choose, would you rather live 100 years in the past or 100 years in the future?
I'll go with the past, just because you kind of know what's happening. There's a
Harold
little
Fromm would call that necrophilia, but anyway.
Yeah, and it is. I'm not comfortable with either answer, honestly. I'll stick with the time period that I'm in. Okay. But
if you had to choose, 100 years, 1918.
Yeah.
Charlie Chaplin, Spanish flu, you're in. You're all in.
Got a poem about the flu.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I bet you'd have more than one.
Yes, then I would have several if I made it through World War I and the influenza.
Yes. Question three. What is your least favorite month?
November. November's a shit month. It's always been a shit month. You know, it's not really winter. It's not really fall. There's been several personal issues and tragedies in November. Mm. November's a month you try and survive.
Okay. Question four. Name a food you wish you liked but don't.
Look at the size of me.
There's got to be something beyond the scope. Anchovies?
I actually don't necessarily mind anchovies. It's not something I request. Squash, Brussels sprouts, I don't know, something like that.
Okay, yeah, see, you'd be smaller if you like Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, yeah, I probably superfoods, I might be able to never get cancer too.
Yeah, you never know, except that you live here. True. Pittsburgh, yes. We're almost through the woods.
This has been a very painless bottom five.
Yeah, very painless bottom five. Question five. What is something most people seem to get but you don't?
Reality television?
That's a good one.
How about that? Reality television. I don't understand it. You know, if you want to know about other people's lives, why don't you just go talk to them?
Yeah, but that's scary and doesn't have jump cuts. So.
All right, yeah. There's not music or anything else, too, to keep it entertaining necessarily. So, yes. Reality television.
Reality television. I like it. Well, I think that's about it. Next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. Our homepage, we're guaranteed you can find new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're on a bunch of podcast subscription services, but anyway. Follow us on Twitter at gonnadiepodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thanks again, Mr. Baldinger.
Thank you, Matt.
Will you be back before the end of the year?
More than likely. There's two books floating. I don't know if they're going to happen before January, but it's possible.
It's possible.
Yeah, maybe that's Christmas. That's ooh. You know, Jason Baldinger tops four books in a year and somehow doesn't lose his fucking mind.
Hey, you never know. And on that happy note, later, meets.
Oh,